From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is being made here in Monroe County, where local doctors are tracking a health crisis. COVID-19 has dominated the year in healthcare, but physicians say there's another crisis that requires a coordinated community effort. They're talking about sexually transmitted infections. A new report from the State Health Department shows that in Monroe County, there was a spike in the number of new HIV diagnoses and a 77% increase in gonorrhea cases in 2020 as compared to 2019. That's the highest countywide increase in the state. More than half of the STIs were diagnosed among people younger than age 26. According to the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine, one in five people in the United States will have an STI in a given year. With this prevalence in mind, medical professionals and community educators are working to eliminate the stigma that comes with this kind of diagnosis. A report co-authored by Trillium Health and ACT Rochester called Sexual Health in Rochester-Monroe County addresses the data. It also urges health professionals to adopt a new comprehensive approach to sexual health. The authors say more open and effective conversations in primary care settings can help patients live lively, sex positive and healthy lives. This hour, we discuss the data and how health professionals can adopt a comprehensive approach to sexual health with our guests. I'd like to welcome now Dr. Bill Valenti. Dr. William Valenti is Senior Vice President for Strategic Advancement, Chief of Innovation, co-founder and staff physician at Trillium Health. Bill, always good to have you. Welcome back to the program.
Good afternoon. Good to be here. Thanks.
Ann Johnson is Executive Director of ACT Rochester. Hi, Ann.
Hi, Evan. Glad to be with you again.
And Javon Cooper is a staff member at the MOCA Center at Trillium Health. Javon, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Hi, Evan. Thank you so much for having me.
And Brian Bartlett is a spokesperson for the HIV Stops With Me campaign. Brian, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for having me.
So, Dr. Valenti, let me just start with you and just ask you, when you look at the numbers in the last year, what stands out to you most, and do we have a sense for why we are seeing increases?
Well, I ask myself, what will it take to get ahead of this? You know, we always like to be ahead of the curve here and prevent these infections. So I'm taking a look at program, what's available, how do we connect with patients, how do we bring sexual health to the forefront. This is a call to action, really, and what this says to me is that we need to take another look at how we're doing things, because what we're doing isn't working. We're missing people.
So I'm looking at, again, the numbers. I mentioned the gonorrhea numbers are up. Looks like HIV is, you know, we'll see a higher number in the last year once we see the final numbers. In 2018, Monroe County has some of the highest rates of chlamydia, gonorrhea, outside of New York City, syphilis. I mean, outside of New York City in the state, this has been the highest numbers. It's going on several years, and it's significantly up in the pandemic. I think, Dr. Valenti, that there might have been an assumption that the pandemic would bring some of those numbers down, given the assumed lack of contact. A year ago, would you have guessed that would happen?
Well, that's what we were thinking. I was a little surprised by the jump in the numbers. And again, it's a sort of a pause to reflect on what's going on here, because all of us have changed our behavior during the pandemic in some way. Add to that problems with access to health care, access to information, people out of jobs, insurance, and financial and transportation issues. And I think, it's this intersection of all of these factors that contribute to the surprise in terms of the increase in numbers. But I should also say that these increases that we're reporting didn't just start with the pandemic, that we had been seeing signals in STDs, STIs, sexually transmitted infections, since 2017, 2018, because we're paying closer attention to it as a part of this end of the HIV epidemic activity.
So we're going to talk this hour about stigma. I mean, and part of that is, you know, if you think about, if listeners think about, what would you think if you or someone you knew was diagnosed, you found out they were diagnosed with gonorrhea, syphilis, chlamydia? You know, I think people may have different ideas about prevalence than is the reality. I think there may be assumptions that are unfair. And we will talk about all of that here. Ann Johnson, from the perspective of ACT Rochester, you know, what do you hope comes out of this?
So when you did your introduction, you talked about the healthcare providers, mm-hmm. and Bill really wants a more detailed sexual history done for patients, especially primary care. What I want, because what ACT tries to do is shine a light on issues in our community, I want to be sure that the general public has a basic understanding. And so this report was written not just for medical professionals, but for the public to understand the definitions, to understand the risk, to know what can happen if you're undiagnosed. And so to me, it's just, again, that awareness so that there's action on both sides, not just the professional, but the patient who's going in is much more open. And, you know, we always talk about what do you not talk about at the dining table, mm-hmm. and it's, you know, politics,
sex and religion
right? And sex.
Yep.
And so it's like, yeah, maybe you're not going to talk about it at a dinner table, but you need to talk about it in smaller groups so that we stop the stigma and that we have information that can help everybody.
Well, we talk about all those things on this program. We don't have any third rails here. But, Ann, do you think that the willingness to talk about this and not feel shame or embarrassment is going to help in a lot of different settings, whether it's in a doctor's office, whether it's just in interactions with friends, communicating with sexual partners? I mean, it seems to me that this goes in a lot of different directions.
It sure does. And if you look at something like early syphilis, I mean, my goodness, with the challenges of infertility these days from heterosexual couples, the last thing you want is to be undiagnosed and have a bigger challenge in growing your family. I mean, some of this is just, it's not, you know, the far end of things. It's basic day-to-day challenges. And early syphilis, if it continues and it grows, you can die from it. I mean, these are important issues that we all need to be aware of and not be afraid to know if we have a challenge and then get it handled.
Before I bring in the other guests here, Dr. Valenti, just on the subject of a detailed sexual history, how is that controversial in any way? And do you have patients who say, you know, you can't ask me that?
In a trusting relationship where the patient is put at ease, that's not a problem. We broach it carefully and thoughtfully with patients, and it's not a one-size-fits-all either. It's a if you get to know the patient, and even if you don't know the patient, putting the patient at ease on that first visit and just opening with something like, you know, as a routine, we talk about your sexual activities, so I'd like to ask you a few questions, you know, sort of lead into it. And you can do it, if you have enough experience with this sort of thing, you can do it quickly and efficiently and accurately. But you need to know the right questions to ask, how to ask them, and also, as health providers, need to have a certain comfort level in terms of asking issues, because this is the most personal kind of information that goes back and forth between a patient and a healthcare person. It needs to be done right.
Yeah, I mean, let me just jump in, Bill. I mean, I say it is certainly the most personal kind of information. But it is also, you know, sex is part of life. And I think for a long time in this country, especially probably compared to many other countries, there was sort of a taboo, as Ann mentioned, about talking about it in certain settings or even just acknowledging that sex is part of life. And I'm not trying to be flippant or sort of blasé about it, but do you sense a change in either your colleagues willing to talk about it, willing to ask about it? Do you sense a change in patients willing to talk about it? Or is it still a case of, I will talk about it when I'm ready or if I trust you?
Well, that's the reason for reframing the discussion mm-hmm. in sexual health rather than it's just getting a sexual history, get it done and get through it and write it down. It's the whole framework needs to change. And I do find that there is some hesitation on the part of some of my colleagues, but when we discuss it in terms of sexual health, talk about destigmatizing sexual activity, those kinds of things, people begin to get the message. Everybody goes into healthcare wanting to do a good job. So it's just a matter of helping people overcome their own, healthcare people overcome their own hesitation in these matters. But the reframe in terms of sexual health is an important aspect of overall health for people and for communities. We begin to reframe the discussion.
Okay, and what do you say to patients if their response to you, Bill, is, I'm not talking about that. You can't ask me about that.
Well, I can honestly say that I can't remember the last time that happened.
Okay.
But I would ask myself, though, probably when I was a lot younger, you know, and less experienced, I'm a little more, diplomatic today. You know, as you get older, you learn how to what you bring up here is this part about engaging with patients, is easing into the discussion and putting people at ease, because we are going to talk about some of the most intimate details of your life. But what I tell people is, you know, this is really important for your health, and this is what I recommend. The other thing that I do is I ask people, do you want the best health care there is, or just average old stuff? And you know what the answer is.
Yeah.
The best health care. So it's a way of sort of easing into the discussion, putting people at ease, and helping them understand that it's a two-way street, and I'm looking out for your health.
I think that's a great question to ask. Do you want the – who's going to say no to wanting the best health care?
Nobody's ever said no.
Nobody's ever said no. So let me bring in Javon Cooper, who's a staff member at the Mocha Center at Trillium Health. How do you see some of these numbers, some of what we're dealing with this community, and in particular, Javon, you know, from what I'm seeing here, based on the data, you know, everybody can be at risk, but non-Hispanic Black individuals, gay, bisexual, and other men who have sex with men are at the highest risk for STIs. So how do you see this issue, and how do you see sort of the communication and public understanding of this?
Thank you, Evan. So I think when the pandemic happened, it exacerbated sort of the social issues that impact why Black queer people are impacted the hardest by STI rates. And I do think that when a lot of services close down, it further emphasized that disconnect to care, and also like the little resources that folks had before they lost. So I think that when you are a marginalized person, like, survival is your number one priority, making sure you have your basic needs. So I think when the pandemic occurred, people were really in survival mode. And I do think that the more complex issues, such as sexual health, take a back seat when your priority is, you know, making sure that you have food, shelter, and employment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's certainly fair. Now, a year into this, if our community is going to learn the lessons you hope that we learn, Javon, what will change now?
So I think a big part of it is, and we've begun to do this at Mocha and Trillium, under like safety protocols and social distancing guidelines, of course, is getting out of the building and getting to people and meeting them where they're at. You know, the reality is that there are a lot of factors that impact people coming into our spaces. And a lot of times it does or doesn't have anything to do with the space itself. I know something that's really important when we're doing this work a year later is framing that, right, like having an STI is just a part of sex. It's a fact of sex. Like most behaviors, even non-sexual, right, like there can be negative effects. And I don't even want to say consequences because I don't want to frame it that way, but there can be negative effects. And I think in our society, particularly in Black communities, it's even more so emphasized by society that having an STI is like a moral failing, huh. which is not true, right? So I think sometimes when people want to access certain services, they say to themselves, well, gee, you know, what, you know, how you mentioned stigma earlier, like, what are people going to think about me? Like, what is me, like, what will this decision that I make for myself sort of reflect and convey to other people? So I think us bringing our services into the community, right, and respecting boundaries, centering, like, the feelings of the folks that we're serving, I think that that can create trust in community, and it can help start a conversation to normalize getting sexual health checkups as a part of your general health care.
Yeah, and, you know, we've talked throughout the pandemic, Jovan, about the effort just to get people willing to listen on the vaccine, given our history in this country of racist health policy, you know, among the many, many others. You know, Tuskegee always comes up, but there's a lot more. And
yeah,
so I'm sure that that impacts the work that you are doing with building trust. And you heard Dr. Valenti talk about building trust. What to you is the key for the medical system to get the kind of trust back? Or I say back, like, I don't know if we've ever really had it among communities of color in this country to the level that we should or should want to achieve. How do you get there?
So most people will say, like, having representation, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. So I do think it's very important to have Black doctors, Black nurses, Black staff, Black specialists. I definitely think it's super important for people to see themselves in their healthcare spaces. But honestly, I think moving forward, particularly after seeing how this pandemic has affected Black communities, making the access to healthcare easy, giving people, right, like giving people free healthcare, mm-hmm, or making it as affordable as possible. I think it's one thing to have a Black doctor, but if your bill is going to be $2,000, what is that really going to do, you know? So I think if we create and advocate for more services that provide marginalized people with free or very cheap, like and accessible and affordable health care, I think that's going to keep, I think that's going to retain people and keep folks around long and not deter people, because that's also another thing that deters communities, right, from health care and getting services, is that it costs a lot of money. It just does. So I think having representation is one thing, but if people can't afford it, they're not going to prioritize it.
I am so glad Jovan brought this up, and I think, you know, it is so important to kind of keep our eyes on who even feels comfortable seeing a doctor in the first place. So it's one thing, as Dr. Valenti has talked about, to build trust, to establish a relationship. It's another, as Jovan mentions, to say, well, do I even have health insurance? If I do, I'm probably on a high deductible. Is this covered? If a high deductible is $6,500, do I really have health care? You know, what does all of that mean for me? And I just have to say, I mean, Ann Johnson, when we think about the challenge in this community of achieving health care at the level we want, I think this effort regarding STIs and trust, but also the pandemic effort, has exposed the fact that, as Jovan mentioned, number one, you may have to go to where the individuals are, meet people where they are, mentally, but also in physical spaces. And number two, you may have to really work through some barriers for people who don't feel like they should even see a doctor unless they are literally dying because of the cost of health care. I mean, I don't mean to be on a rant here, Ann, but that is the reality for a lot of people.
That is the reality. And I think what's happened with the pandemic is, as was already said, it's forcing us to think differently. How do we make sure that everybody has access to what we need? And, of course, with all the social and racial justice issues that have been visible for this last 12 months, more people are talking about it, getting engaged in it, thinking about ways to address things that we haven't before. And we felt really that this timing of highlighting the STIs and that we're going in the wrong direction needed to be thought of in that whole scope of access to care so that we can be more healthy.
Well, and look, Dr. Valenti, let me just tell you a brief story of someone that I know who has a condition that occasionally makes for sort of constricted air spaces and swallowing. And this person had a piece of food lodged in their throat and did not want to even go to the doctor and wanted to try to sleep sitting up because maybe it would pass overnight, because if they went to the doctor with a high deductible, we're talking about a $5,800 bill just to get a piece of food dislodged. And that person might have been me. And I am one of the most privileged people you'll ever meet. And I literally sat there on my couch, Bill, going, I don't know if I need to do this. Come on. I'm going to go have a piece of steak popped out of my throat here because I have eosinophilic esophagitis. Yes. I mean, like, I am at the top of the list of advantage in this society. And I was thinking about not getting care in what was probably an emergency situation. It was an emergency situation. Now I want to think about the people that Javon is talking about and the people that Trillium works with and Mocha works with, and think about not just representation, but also how scared are you of what the bill's going to be? Is the cost of this going to wreck your life? I don't know how we get past that without some significant changes, Bill.
We work on this constantly. You know, Trillium Health is over 30 years old now. And when we started out as an HIV clinic in 1989, the mantra was, care for all regardless of ability to pay. We've really stuck to that. As a community health center, we can offer discounted care, sliding fee scales, they call them. We also have insurance navigators on board to help people access insurance and make care affordable. But you're absolutely correct that is a huge barrier, cost of care, insurance, et cetera. And needs is also a part of the solution here, that in order to get the job done, you have to eliminate barriers like stigma, et cetera, and add the cost of health care to that. But it takes a conscious effort to try and get ahead of that one. But we've been on it for 30 years and really do make the effort, and even at that, people drop out of care for any number of reasons, and I think Javon hit it in terms of highlighting the essentials of living that often come first.
Javon, do you think that we will achieve the level of health care we want in our community, in our society, if we don't change essentially the health systems that we have in this country? I mean, the system of how people get cared, insured, et cetera?
To be honest, no. And I think Dr. V further highlighted the point that it's something that our organization has been doing. And I've seen it. And I've seen it in my organization, and I've seen it in other organizations. And I know it works. But I think you hit the nail on the head, Evan, that if it doesn't change from a structural top-down perspective, it'll happen in pockets or instances, but that, you know, like that's not going to help communities at large.
Mm-hmm. All right. I want to take our only break of the hour, and when we come back, I want to bring in Brian Bartlett, who's a spokesperson for the HIV Stops With Me campaign, as we talk about understanding STI in our community, taking some of the stigma out of it, thinking about the barriers to care, and understanding maybe why our community, Monroe County especially, has significantly higher numbers if you go down the list of STI, syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia, more than most communities outside of New York City in our state. So our guests include Dr. Bill Valenti, Senior Vice President for Strategic Advancement, the Chief of Innovation and Co-Founder and Staff Physician at Trillium Health, Ann Johnson, Executive Director of ACT Rochester, Javon Cooper, Staff Member of the MOCA Center at Trillium Health, and we'll bring in Brian Bartlett next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about weight shaming that happens in doctor's offices. When we talked about BMI on Connections recently, we were moved by the number of emails and phone calls we got from Connections listeners who described very difficult experiences they had with their own doctors, to the point where some won't even go back to see a doctor. So how can the medical profession communicate more effectively? And what should we as patients know and expect? That's next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We used to have Healthy Fridays on this program. We don't really do themed Fridays anymore, but have you noticed a theme? We're talking about patient advocacy, understanding a number of things in our community that's happening right now, and this hour, it's on STIs. Before I get to our next guest, let me get a phone call. This is Peter in Rochester. Go ahead, Peter.
Thank you for taking my call. some of the facts. Where are kids learning most about sex these days?
Probably the internet.
Right. And it's harsher, it's fantastic, it's entertainment, and it doesn't have a lot of condoms. How often in school are they getting taught sex ed?
I mean, I know I don't know if it's a rhetorical question, Peter. I think most experts would say probably still not enough, but I don't know.
And what's the Catholic Church's stance on condoms?
Mm. Yeah, we can certainly talk about contraceptives and whatnot as it relates to a certain population of the school.
All right, that was my intro. The deal is these are kids, okay? You remember what it was like as a kid? You don't even have your, like, frontal lobes cooked yet. So we got to get over this whole, oh, the stigma. It's like, you got a serious problem. They need to be hammered home every day. There are diseases out there. Every day they got to be reminded. Or it's on us. It's a leadership problem.
Okay. Well, look, Peter, I certainly appreciate the idea that we can teach and do it more effectively. I think, Javon, and let me ask you, Javon, I know you're concerned about just setting the idea that there are sort of, I think the word you used was consequences. You want to avoid certain terms with certain people. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
I think in relation to the caller's question, his last statement, I actually do think is very effective. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of content and information on the internet and in media that is very inaccurate and sensationalizes sex. So I do think that, like Peter said, the caller, children are going to interact with this media, mm-hmm. like whether we want them to or not, they're going to. So we do need to sit children down and like have very frank conversations like, look, you're going to see a lot of things and it's going to be exciting and titillating and stimulating. Like that's a very natural human response. But let's talk about the implications and consequences of these behaviors, the content that you're engaging with. It doesn't always happen like that, like rarely doesn't happen like that. Like that's a very performed, hyperbolized sort of iteration of the act. Let me sit you down and tell you, like, if you happen to be in a situation where you want to engage in sex, like these are the very real things and the very real material effects that can come from that. It can be very exciting and very pleasurable, but it can also come with a lot of things that you may not understand and be prepared to internalize. So I definitely do think that we have to just be very frank about we have to be very frank about sex, and we have to be very frank with the fact that younger people are doing it. Like, it's constantly marketed towards them and shoved down their throats. So it's naive of us as a society to think that it's not going to happen. And the more that we pretend it doesn't happen and that they don't know what they're doing, we're going to see these rates and these numbers.
I really appreciate, you know, especially Peter pointing out that if younger people, kids, teenagers, are really getting their first exposure to sex on the internet, and that is happening literally for millions, he's right. They're not going to see a lot of safe practices in condom use. How are we doing with condom use, Dr. Valenti?
Uneven, not enough. So we continue to talk about condoms, testing, regular screening, and also use these regular screening visits with patients to talk about condoms. But another safer sex kinds of activities. But you're right that condom use has fallen off, and we're seeing it at the other end in terms of new infections. So as a part of our overall prevention strategy, and Javon outlined some other things, including a well-informed parents, children, and also some of that taking place in school, we might be able to get ahead of it.
Well, and let me also just say, as we turn to Brian Bartlett for his story, Peter's point is important for anyone who wants to sort of wish away the idea of sex and teenagers. And I mean, again, I'm not saying anything is inevitable, but I'm saying, you know, just sort of a fingers in your ears and closing your eyes approach to this. The internet is a different world out there, especially for adults who grew up without it. So please be aware of everything that is out there and how fast and easy kids will learn how to find it. Teenagers will learn how to find it, and they will find all kinds of stuff. And I think it's valuable just to keep that in mind. Brian Bartlett is a spokesperson for the HIV Stops With Me campaign. First of all, Brian, what is the campaign? Tell us what it's all about.
Hi, Evan. So the HIV Stops With Me campaign is a program through the New York State Department of Health, and it's a multifaceted social media and marketing campaign every year with its focus on destigmatizing the facts really about HIV by putting to the forefront up to 30 New Yorkers across the state living with HIV and openly sharing their experiences and stories as of such to help you know, bring that stigma down.
So tell us about your story.
Sure. I have been openly HIV positive for the past 11 years. More or less, I acquired HIV just before turning 21. It was through sexual assault, which was a very, you know, unique experience in the sense that not everyone acquires HIV in very traumatic settings. And, you know, inherently not everyone always asks for it to happen either, because that's not always the case. And I, to bank off of the fact that I didn't really know much about HIV prior to my diagnosis, I was really given fear tactics in high school. And
can I ask what you mean by that?
Sure. Well, you know, like my health class, I recall receiving information about STIs and HIV, but was really given the ideology that, you know, sex is scary and not approachable, and that just the improper level of education that I've only received later as an adult in my life.
Sure. Okay. So I didn't mean to jump in. I mean, I didn't mean to interrupt the story. I just want to make sure we understood, because I suspect a lot of people will share that experience that you had. But please continue. I'm sorry for interrupting.
Yeah, no, it's fine. I didn't receive my diagnosis until a few years later down the road. And, you know, it's kind of like when you receive a diagnosis for HIV, a lot of what comes into your head is backed up by these decades of the stigma, the buildup, the history of what we understand HIV as. And, you know, what HIV is as a virus has really impacted communities and countries over the years and this decades and this pandemic that continues. And, you know, it took some time, and finally there's research, and finally there is investment and education and understanding of this virus. and an understanding in how we can help people. And with these medications that are out, all that combined now, there's still this wave of stigma, that this wall of stigma that we have to, you know, climb over. And that really hits you when you receive a diagnosis. And, you know, it was a turning point in my life where I decided, you know, I wasn't going to let this define me. It's not something that's going to change my life. This is a life, that, you know, this is a door opening for me. It's not a death sentence, as a lot of what that stigma in the history of the virus really is. It's a life sentence, and it's an opportunity to start new. And so since then, and for the past 6 or 7 years, I've been undetectable, which means that I take my medication, which is one pill a day, every day, and it suppresses the virus to a point where I cannot pass it on to another partner.
The term life sentence and not a death sentence, what a powerful way to think about it. Dr. Valenti, how do you like that framing?
It's true, and it says it all. And makes you stop and think. But exactly, because remember that a lot of people, especially those people who have been around since the early days of the HIV epidemic, think of it as in death sentence terms. So we want to, again, reframe that discussion and put the emphasis where it needs to be. And Brian hit it, and when he said the life sentence aspect is treatment for life.
Treatment for life, just one pill a day. But Brian, if you think back to the days after you got the diagnosis, what were the ideas you had about what that meant for you at the time?
I honestly had lots of different thoughts reeling in my head. I had a lot of concepts on, you know, these concepts of the ideas of will I be able to move out of a place like Rochester, which has an incredible place like Trillium Health providing HIV care to so many clients, which I also work at Trillium Health as well. And ideas of if I could ever, you know, be in a relationship or fall in love, if I could be able to be within physical contact of my family and friends, all of these things that are so 100%, I can do all of these things and I can do more. And I've proven to myself that I can over the years. But you don't really think about that because we're not really educated enough about what HIV really is. And it, you know, that plays into this perpetual stigma in society. You know, stigma is built around ignorance, and ignorance is combated by education. And we fear we don't understand. And if we choose to really sit down and put a human face and an understanding to something that we fear, we'll be able to understand it better. And, you know, that's part of the process of finding these medications for HIV over the decades. And that's part of the process of, you know, trying to end the epidemic. And, you know, here I am today, undetectable and, you know, thriving, living with HIV.
That's great. And I'd like to read an email to you if I could, Brian. Because as we talk about the fact that sex is part of life, you know, there may be a lot of worry that comes to mind for people who receive certain diagnoses, not the least of which would be an HIV diagnosis. Will I be healthy? Will the medication work? Will I live a long life? Will I be able to have sex? Will I be able to have partners? Will I be able to be in a relationship? These are natural questions, I think. And I think an email from Patrick will you know, be sort of instructive here. So let me go ahead and read this. He says, I had a really good experience this summer regarding a potential partner. Before any intimacy occurred, she disclosed to me that she carries an STI, and she was concerned that if I became a carrier, that I would be angry with her. It was shocking, and I didn't know what to do at the time, so I sent my doctor an email and asked him about it. He proceeded to call me on the phone. He wanted to have an actual conversation with me. We were able to sort everything out. I was able to go back and have an open conversation with her about what I learned and how to approach sex. It was important to me not to stigmatize this person. She's a very good person. The point is that she did the right thing by disclosing her medical history to me, and I did the right thing by reaching out to a professional and became educated on the subject. I've got a fantastic primary care doctor who also works in maternity, and I figured he dealt with this stuff all the time, more than me. It made him the perfect person to talk to. I was able to have two very targeted conversations, which helped me sort through everything and reduce stigma for a potential sexual partner. What do you make of that, Brian?
That makes my heart sing. That's honestly the best way to approach this. Sounds like Patrick really approached the situation in a very open-minded and in a very open-minded way, and very willing to educate and understand this more, and sought out someone that could better educate him on an understanding behind STIs, and most importantly, not making this potential partner feel different, feel alone, feel small, or feel wrong. As Devon mentioned in prior, that like STIs are part of our health, and they're very normal, and they should never make anyone feel any differently from anyone else, and they don't define you. And it's very, I appreciate that I can hear someone having that kind of a situation that makes someone else feel just as human as they are in this.
And I want to give you space to answer or not answer, but I'm just curious, Brian, I mean, have you navigated situations where you've had to maybe work with a possible partner about understanding what certain things meant, or have you had any barriers there?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Kind of part of the process of living with HIV is that you kind of become an ambassador of something that you kind of by proxy become an ambassador of something that you may have to educate a lot of people on, mm-hmm. because a lot of people don't really understand it. And there have been many occasions where I've had to educate partners on ways that we can practice safer sex methods. And the ways that you can do that, there are many, that include such things as condoms and PrEP, which is a pre-exposure prophylaxis, which is a once-a-day medication that's kind of like birth control for HIV that can protect you from transmission with your partner. And, yeah, you kind of like you fall into that, essentially, educating as you go along in life. Mm.
Dr. Villani, what did you think of Patrick's email?
Well, that's the way it's supposed to work. That is sexual health at its finest.
Yeah, I do appreciate that, Patrick, and good luck to you. And so in our remaining minutes here, I want to talk to all of our guests about how they see a productive path forward and maybe what needs to change in the community. And what we will do is we will set aside the fact that we can't change the healthcare system entirely in 5 minutes. And, you know, you're operating within a system as it is right now. So some of it's education, different practices, communication, resource availability. Brian Bartlett, what would you like to see change next?
Honestly, I think part of the process, I think the biggest things that I would like to change is that is just a continued reframe of an understanding of what HIV really is. And that goes into being a part of this campaign. You know, my face is slung up on billboards and commercials, and I'm even on Grindr ads and ads on YouTube. And it's exciting because I have people that I know that contact me and they say that they see my face and they're reminded about HIV and what it means to live with it and what it means to get tested and know your status and protect yourself from HIV and STIs. But I also get once a day people that I don't know, people from all other parts of the country and other countries messaging me and saying thank you because they don't feel alone in their own status and they feel like this is an opportunity that the world feels more open to them. And I think that continued destigmatization would really help on a global spectrum for sure.
All right. Javon Cooper, what do you think?
I would like to see more affordable health care.
Sticking with that theme. I mean, that's at the core of everything, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. And to be even more specific, I would like to see programs that assist with the cost of health care.
Mm-hmm. Are you at all confident that either at the state or federal level that is happening anytime soon, Javon?
Yes, I am.
You are? I admit I'm sort of surprised by that. So what gives you that optimism?
Because I see it in my organization, and I've seen it I've traveled a lot, and I've seen it at different organizations as well. So I'm confident that it is a framework that we're going to continue to move toward in the future. So I don't see it sweeping the nation, but I definitely see more folks talking about it and seeing how they can implement it in their respective agencies.
Okay. Ann Johnson, what needs to happen next?
I think people who are outside of the healthcare and traditionally engaged with knowing about Trillium need to know more. You know, this is ACT Rochester's sixth major community report, and it's the first one we've done in partnership with someone outside of my support organization, which is Rochester Area Community Foundation. And as you may imagine, you know, there were some questions as to why this. But 10 different indicators on ACT Rochester's website are STI indicators. And what Bill and I talked about when we agreed this was a good thing was that we needed to shine a light on it. And so I feel blessed after especially being on this call to hear words like, living, you know, a life sentence and doing the right things. And we just need to help more people be able to do that. And I'm hoping, because we spent some time on the cover making it very colorful and curious and evocative, that people will pick up this report, read it, and do more of their own learning based on what their situation is.
Where do they find it?
ActRochester.org.
All right. Dr. Valenti, what do you want to see happen next?
Yep. Look at this as a community issue. Sexual health, good sexual health is good community health. And then think again for my healthcare colleagues about the vignette that you gave us earlier, Patrick's experience, his own free of stigma approach to things, and the interaction with the physician. That's the way it's supposed to be.
Well, and I've got time to squeeze in a couple more emails, and on the subject of communication, here's an email from Amy who says, "Evan, I've had genital herpes for 38 years. It never occurred to me back then that I could get a sexually transmitted virus. I thought it only happened to, quote, certain people. I got it from a, quote, nice boy. I thought he didn't know he had it, but he told me that he hadn't disclosed it to me because I didn't ask. Since then, I have always asked new potential partners and told each person, and sometimes that hasn't been pleasant, but I would rather not be like the person who gave it to me." That is from Amy. So, Brian, it's a different experience for her. And in her experience, she always wants to disclose in advance. She was told by the partner who gave it to her that, hey, you didn't ask. Is that acceptable to you? What's the sort of the ethical code that you think ought to be in play here?
That's definitely not acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, yeah, no, it's unfortunate to hear this, but it sounds like what she's taken from the situation is learning how important open communication is and honesty in these situations with partners and regarding STIs. And, you know, this is part of the process of better, part of the process of education is, you know, talking about these things openly with each other at all times with any of our partners.
I would think, Javon Cooper, that, you know, as difficult as it can be to be upfront, part of removing stigma is to normalize the conversation. How do you see it?
I agree. I definitely think that it's the ethical thing to let someone know. And on the other side of that, I try to hold both parties accountable in a way to not vilify folk as well.
Mm-hmm.
So as much as I encourage people to be upfront about their health situation, I also encourage folks to be proactive about their health situation. So I don't, you know, so I try to operate from a place that holds both parties accountable. But I mean, if I were the person, I definitely would be upfront about my health situation.
Sure, yeah. And Dr. Valenti, Scott writes in to say, "I want to know, as a person living with HIV and on life-saving medications, how people like me are supposed to interpret the rapid pace of research and resolution around the COVID vaccine while we still do not have that resolution for HIV." Dr. Valenti?
We're going to learn from the COVID experience in terms of more about the immune system than we ever thought possible. So I would stay tuned on that. They're two different viruses, is the short story, but I think the early returns, especially with mRNA technology for a COVID vaccine, opens up the door for a whole new way of looking at HIV vaccines. So I'm optimistic.
Okay, and you know, I mean, I want to honor Scott's concern. I mean, it certainly sounds like, I mean, everybody wants to see an HIV vaccine happen. But for those who have seen the rather slow progress on an HIV vaccine vis-a-vis a COVID vaccine, I want to just stress the point again one more time, Dr. Valenti, in our last 30 seconds or so. Different viruses, different challenges, and by no means an indication that we should be skeptical about the pace of the COVID vaccines.
No, not at all skeptical about the pace of the COVID vaccine. We've been studying coronaviruses for more than 10 years, and that technology, the mRNA technology and other vaccine technologies, have been around for a long time. It was a good intersection and an opportunity that worked.
All right. Well, I want to thank our guests. A great conversation this hour. The report at ActRochester.org. Ann Johnson, Executive Director of ACT Rochester. Thanks for being here as always, Ann.
Thank you.
Dr. Bill Valenti, Senior Vice President for Strategic Advancement, the Chief of Innovation, co-founder and staff physician at Trillium Health. Thank you, Dr. Valenti. And Javon Cooper, staff member at the Mocha Center at Trillium Health. Thank you, Javon.
Thank you so much, Evan. It was a pleasure.
Pleasure was mine. Brian Bartlett, spokesperson for the HIV Stops With Me campaign, and also a member and worker at Trillium Health. Thank you, Brian. Thanks for the work you're doing.
Thank you so much, Evan. Thank you for having us.
You got it. More connections coming up in just a moment.